Few weeks later, Dalmar tracked me down. I'd never met Dalmar. I was in a bar minding my own business when he wandered in. I was the new kid on the block, their plaything. Everyone seems to have something to hold over my head. And so it was out of necessity that when Dalmar claimed some dude had stolen his stuff, I went in to get it. I was paid generously. I could cover the rent, take care of Ma, eat. But with every dollar I earned was also the knowledge that I belonged to someone other than me. Every day she moves a little farther from the cabin. One day she goes to the bottom of the stairs, another day her feet touch the grass. Today she moves onto the dirt, knowing all the while that I sit at the window and watch her. She sits on the cold, hard earth, becoming numb as she draws. I imagine the air closing in on her, her fingers stiff. I can't see what she's drawing, but I imagine. Bark and branches, what's left of the trees now that the leaves are completely gone. She draws tree after tree. She doesn't waste an inch of the precious paper. She closes the notebook and starts to walk down to the lake, where she sits on the banks alone. I watch as she finds rocks and attempts to skip them across the surface of the lake. They all sink. She lets her feet take her along the lake's shore, not too far, a dozen or so feet to a spot that she's never been before. It isn't that I think she's going to go. It's that suddenly I don't want to be in the cabin alone. She turns at the sound of crunching leaves behind her. I'm tromping out toward the lake, my hands stuffed into the pockets of my jeans, my neck buried into the scruff of the coat.
"Checking on me?"
she asks impassively before I arrive. I stop beside her. "Do I need to?" We stand side by side without saying a thing. My coat brushes her arm and she steps away. I wonder if she could ever get this right, this scene, in her sketchpad. The shape of the blue lake and the leaves spilled across the ground, the forest green pine and evergreen trees, the enormous sky. Could she ever get the wind whipping through the remains of trees? Could she draw the cold air that eats at our hands and ears until they burn? I start to walk away. "You want to walk, don't you?" I ask when she doesn't follow. She does. "Then let's go," I say, though all the time I stay two steps ahead. Between us, there's nothing but dead air. I don't know how big this lake is. It's big. I don't know how deep it gets at its deepest point. I don't know what its name is. The shoreline is rugged, with rocky overlooks that peek down on the water. The evergreen trees come right up to the shores. There's no beach. They circle the entire periphery of the lake, huddled close together, fighting each other for a view. The leaves crunch beneath our feet like foam chips. She fights to keep her balance on the jagged ground. I don't wait for her. We continue for a long time, until we can no longer see the cabin through the trees. I'm sure her feet are killing her in those stupid shoes, the ones she had on when we left. Fancy work shoes. But the cold air and the exercise feel good. A change from sitting around in the cabin feeling sorry for ourselves. She asks something, but I don't hear. I wait for her to catch up. "What?" I ask sharply. I'm not one for small talk.
"You have any brothers?"
"No."
"Sisters?"
"You always have to talk," I ask. She passes ahead and takes the lead.
"You always have to be so rude?"
she asks. I don't say a thing. This is the gist of our conversations. The next day she's outside again, moving aimlessly around the lot. She isn't stupid enough to go where I can't see her. Not yet. Because she knows she'll lose this privilege. She's afraid of the unknown. Of Dalmar, maybe. Of what I'd do if she tried to run. It's fear that keeps her within my line of sight. She could make a run for it, but there's nowhere to go. She has the gun. She could shoot me, but of course she hasn't figured out how to shoot the damn thing. As far as she's concerned, I'm worth keeping around just for that. but with the gun in her possession, I don't have to listen to the bitching anymore. For the time being, she's content. She can go outside and freeze her ass off. She can draw God knows what all day long. She comes back in sooner than I expect. In her arms, there's a filthy cat. It isn't that I hate cats. It's just that food is scarce. Heat is scarce. There isn't enough room for the two of us in here, much less three. And I'm not sharing. Her eyes beg, please. If I see that cat in here again, I say, I'll shoot it. I'm not in the mood to be a good Samaritan.
Gabe, before. After waiting for what seemed an eternity, in reality it's about 3 weeks, we finally get a good tip. An Indian woman living in a high-rise on Kenmore is certain our John Doe is her neighbor. Apparently, she had been out of town for a while, and this is the first time she's seen his face on TV. So I bring back up and make my way downtown, again. The high-rise is located in Uptown. Certainly not the best neighborhood in the city. Not the worst either. Far from it. It's a mix of people who can't quite afford the classier areas like Lakeview or Lincoln Park, and an eclectic mix of men and women who just stepped off the boat. It's very diverse. Ethnic restaurants line the streets, and not just Chinese and Mexican. There's Moroccan and Vietnamese and Ethiopian joints. Regardless of its diversity, nearly half the population of Uptown is still white. It's relatively safe to walk around at night. Uptown is known for its nightlife of historic theaters and bars. Many well-known names have made the trip to Uptown to perform for nobodies like me. I find the apartment building in Double Park. Last thing I'm going to do is donate another penny to the city of Chicago to park my car. The butch cop and I head inside and take the elevator to the unit. There's no answer and the door is locked. Of course. So we beg the landlord to let us in. She's an old lady who hobbles along beside us and refuses to let us borrow the key. You can't trust anyone these days, she says. She tells us that the unit is rented by a woman named Celeste Manfredo. She had to look it up in her files. She knows nothing about the woman other than she pays her rent on time. But, of course, the unit could be a sublet. How would we know? I ask. The old lady shrugs. We wouldn't. Tenants are required to sublet their own units or pay to break the lease. There's no paperwork. I can't pick up Sudafed at the pharmacy without having to sign away my life. None that I keep. The tenants are still required to pay rent. Anything happens, it's their problem, not mine. I take the key from her hands and let myself in. The landlord pushes her way into the apartment beside Butch and me. I have to ask her more than once not to touch anything. I'm not sure what strikes me first. An overturned lamp, lights on in the middle of the day, or the contents of a woman's purse scattered across the floor. I reach into my pocket for a pair of latex gloves and roam the apartment. There's a stack of mail on the kitchen counter, hidden beneath an overdue library book. I check out the address label. Every single one of them has been sent to a Michael Collins at a P.O. box in the city. Butch slips her hands in latex and heads to the purse. She delves in and finds a wallet, and inside a driver's license. Mia Dennett, she says aloud, though of course we both knew exactly what it would say. I want phone records, I say, and fingerprints, and we need to canvass the building, every unit. Is there a security camera? I ask the landlord. She says that there is. I need everything you have from October 1. I examine the wall. Concrete. No one would have heard a thing that happened inside this room.
Colin. Before. She wants to know how much I got paid for this. She asks too many questions. I didn't get paid a damn thing, I remind her. I get paid for finishing a job.
How much were you offered?
None of your damn business, I say. We're in the bathroom, of all places. She's on her way in, I'm on my way out. I don't bother to tell her the water is ice cold.
Does my father know about this?
I told you already, I don't know. The ransom was to be collected from her father. That I know. but I don't have a damn clue what Dalmar did when I didn't show up with the girl. She smells of morning breath, her hair a labyrinth of dirty blonde. She closes the door on me and I hear the water begin to run. I try not to imagine her stripping away her clothes and stepping into the piercing water. When she comes out, she's drying the ends of her hair with a towel. I'm in the kitchen eating granola and freeze-dried milk. I've forgotten what it tastes like to eat real food. I've got all the cash spread out on the table, and I'm counting what we've got left. She eyes the cash. We're not broke, not yet. That's a good thing. She tells me how she always thought some disgruntled convict would shoot her father on the courthouse steps. In her voice, I hear a different story. She didn't think it would happen. She hoped. She's standing in the hallway. I can see her shiver, but she doesn't whine about being cold. Not this time.
He was a litigation lawyer before becoming a judge. He got involved in a number of class action suits, asbestos cases. He never protected the good guy. People were dying of these horrible things. Mesothelioma, asbestosis. And he's trying to save the big corporations a buck or two. He never talked about his work. Attorney-client privilege, he said. But I know he just didn't want to talk, period. But I'd sneak into his office at night when he was asleep. At first I was snooping because I wanted to prove he was having an affair in the hopes my mother might actually leave him. I was a kid, 13, 14. I didn't know what mesothelioma was. But I could read well enough. Coughing up blood, heart palpitations, lumps under the skin. Nearly half of those infected died within a year of diagnosis. You didn't even have to work with asbestos to be exposed. Wives and children were dying because their fathers brought it home on their clothes. The more successful he was, the more we were threatened. My mother would find letters in the mail. They knew where we lived. There were phone calls. Men hoping Grace, my mother and I would die as painful a death as their wives and children had. Then he became a judge. His face was all over the news. All these headlines with his name. He was harassed all the time, but after a while we stopped paying attention to these unsubstantiated threats. He let it go to his head. It made him feel important. The more people he pissed off, the better he was doing his job.
There's nothing to say. I'm not good at this kind of crap. I can't handle small talk, and I certainly can't handle sympathy. The reality is that I know nothing about the scumbag who thought it would be in his best interest to threaten some bastard's kid. That's the way this business works. Guys like me, we're kept in the dark. We carry out an assignment without really knowing why. That way we can't point fingers. Not that I try. I know what would happen to me if I did. Dalmar told me to nab the girl. I didn't ask why. That way when the cops catch me and I'm in the interrogation room, I can't answer their underhanded questions. I don't know who hired Dalmar. I don't know what they want with the girl. Dalmar told me to get her. I did. And then I changed my mind. I stare up from my bowl and look at her. Her eyes beg me to say something, some grand confession that's going to explain it all to her, that's going to help her understand why she's here, why her instead of the bitchy sister, why her instead of the insolent judge. She's desperate for an answer to it all. How is it in the blink of an eye everything can change, her family, her life, her existence? She searches in vain, thinking I know the answer, thinking some lowlife like me might be able to help her see the light. $5,000, I say.
What?
This wasn't what she expected to hear. I stand from the chair and it skids across the wooden floors. My footsteps are loud. I rinse the bowl with water from the faucet. I let it drop to the sink and she jumps. I turn to her. They offered me $5,000.
Eve, before. I let my days go to waste. Oftentimes it's hard to get out of bed, and when I do, the very first thought on my mind is Mia. I wake up sobbing in the middle of the night, night after endless night, hurrying downstairs so I don't wake James. I'm stricken with grief at all waking hours. In the grocery store, I'm certain I see Mia shopping the cereal aisle, stopping myself only moments before throwing my arms around a complete stranger. Later in the car, I go to pieces, unable to leave the parking lot for over an hour as I watch mothers with their children enter the store, holding hands as they cross the lot, mothers lifting small children into the basket of the shopping cart. For weeks, I've seen her face flash across the TV screen and a sketch of that man. But now, there are more important things happening in the world. It's both a blessing and a curse, I suppose. The reporters are less intrusive these days. They don't hound me in the driveway, follow me on my errands. The harassing phone calls and interview requests are on sabbatical. I can open my curtains without seeing a flood of reporters line the sidewalk before our home. But their withdrawal worries me as well. They've grown apathetic to the name Mia Dennett, tired of waiting for a front-page headline that may never come. Mia Dennett returns home, or maybe Dennett girl found dead. It settles upon me like dark clouds descending on a winter day that I will never know. I think of those families who are reunited with their loved ones' remains 10, sometimes 20 years later, and wonder if that will be me. When I tire of the crying, I let the fury take control, shattering imported Italian crystal goblets against the kitchen wall, and when they're done, James's grandmother's dinnerware. I scream at the top of my lungs, a barbaric sound that certainly doesn't belong to me. I sweep the mess before James arrives home, tucking a million pieces of shattered glass in the garbage bin beneath the dead philodendron so he won't see. I spend an entire afternoon watching the robins en route to places south, Mississippi and such for the winter. They arrive one day on our back porch, dozens of them, fat and cold, stocking up on whatever they can find for the journey ahead. It rained that day, and the worms were everywhere. I watched them for hours, sad when they leave. It will be months before they return, those red bellies that beckon spring. Another day, the ladybugs arrive, thousands of them, soaking up the sun on the back door. It's an Indian summer day, warm with temperatures in the upper 60s and plentiful sun. The kind of day we long for in the fall, the colours of the trees at their peak. I try to count them all, but they scatter away and more come, and it's impossible to keep track. I don't know how long I watch them. I wonder what the ladybugs will do for the winter. Will they die? And then, days later, when a frost covers the earth, I think of those ladybugs and cry. I think of Mia when she was a child. I think of the things we did. I walked to the playground I used to take Mia to while Grace was in school for the day and sit on the swings. I rake my hand through the sand in the sandbox and sit on a bench and stare. At the children. At the fortunate mothers who still had theirs to hold. But mostly, I think of the things I didn't do. I think of the time I stood idly by when James told Mia that a B wasn't good enough in high school chem, and the time she brought home a breathtaking impressionist painting she'd spent more than a month on at school. He scoffed. If only you'd spend that kind of time on chemistry, you might have gotten an A. I think of myself, watching out of the corner of my eye, unable to say a thing. Unable to point out the vacant expression on our daughter's face, because I was afraid he might get mad. When Mia informed James that she didn't plan to go to law school, he said she didn't have a choice. She was 17, hormones raging, and she pleaded, "Mom!" desperate. Just this one time for me to step in and intervene. I'd been washing dishes, trying my hardest to evade the conversation. I remember the desperation on Mia's face, the displeasure on James's. I chose the lesser of two evils. "Mia," I said, "I'll never forget the day." the sound of the telephone ringing in the background, though none of us paid it the time of day, the smell of something I'd burnt in the kitchen, cold spring air wafting in a window I'd opened to get rid of the smell. The sun was staying out later, something we might comment on if we weren't so preoccupied with upsetting Mia. "It means so much to him," I said. "He wants you to be like him." She stormed out of the kitchen, and upstairs she slammed a door. Mia dreamed of studying at the Art Institute of Chicago. She wanted to be an artist. It was all that had ever mattered to her. But James refused. Mia started a countdown that very day to her 18th birthday, and she started packing a box of things she would take with her when she left. "The ducks and geese fly overhead. Everyone is leaving me. I wonder if somewhere Mia's looking toward the sky, seeing the same thing."
Colin, before. What we have is time to think, and a lot of it. That damn cat keeps hanging around now that the girl is sacrificing scraps of her own dinner for it. She found a moth-eaten blanket in the closet and, with an empty box from the back of my truck, created a makeshift bed for the stupid thing. She has it set up in the shed out back. Every day she takes it a few bites of food. She has a name for the damn thing. Canoe. Not that she bothered to tell me, but I heard her call to it this morning when it wasn't sleeping in its bed. Now she's worried. I sit by the lake and fish. I'll eat trout every day for the rest of my God-given life if it means I don't have to eat something that's been freeze-dried. Most often I come up with northern pike, then walleye, sometimes trout. I can tell from the light spots on the northern, that and the fact that they're always the first bastards to take the bait. The fish are stocked every year, mostly fry and fingerlings, sometimes yearlings. The smallmouth bass give me the most damn trouble. Until I get them on the ground, I'd bet my life they're twice the size they turn out to be. Strong bastards. I spend most of my time thinking about how we're going to pull this off. About how I'm going to pull this off. Food is running low, which means a trip to the store. I have the money, I just don't know what it will take for someone to recognize me. And what do I do with the girl when I'm gone? The disappearance of a judge's daughter? That's breaking news. I'd bet my life on it. Any store clerk is going to recognize her and call the cops. Which makes me wonder. Have the cops figured out I was with her the night she disappeared? Is my face like hers all over the fucking TV? Maybe that's a good thing, I tell myself. Not for me, not if it means I get caught. But if Valerie sees my face on the TV, sees that I'm a person of interest in the disappearance of a Chicago woman, then she'll know what to do. She'll know I'm not there to make sure there's food on the table and the doors are shut. She'll know what needs to be done. When the girl isn't paying attention, I pull a photo from my wallet. It's worn with time, shriveled around the edges from all the times I've pulled it from my wallet and forced it back in. I wonder if and when the money arrived, the money I swiped from the truck stop in Eau Claire. I wonder if she knew it was for me. She would have known I was in trouble when the money arrived, $500 or more crammed in an envelope with no return address. I'm not one to be sentimental. I just need to know that she's okay. It's not like she's alone. At least that's what I tell myself. The neighbor comes by once a week, gets the mail, and checks on her. They'll see the money. When Sunday comes and goes and I don't show, they'll know. If they haven't already seen my face on the TV, if Valerie hasn't already seen my face on TV and gone to check on her to make sure she's okay, I try and convince myself Valerie is there. Everything is okay. I almost believe it. Later that night, we're outside. I'm attempting to grill fish for dinner, except there's no charcoal, so I'm seeing what else I can burn to start a fire. The girl's sitting on the porch, wrapped in a blanket that she snagged from inside. Her eyes scan the land below. She's wondering where the damn cat is. She hasn't seen it in 2 days, and she's worried. It's getting colder out there all the time. Sooner or later, the thing won't survive.
I take it you're not a bank teller,
she says. What do you think? I ask. She takes it as a no.
What do you do then?
She asks.
Do you work?
I work.
Anything legal?
I do what I need to do to survive, just like you.
I don't think so,
she says. And why is that?
I earn an honest living. I pay taxes.
How do you know I don't pay taxes?
Do you pay taxes?
She asks. I work, I say. I earn an honest living. I pay taxes. I've mopped the floors of the john at some realtor's office, washed dishes, loaded crates into a truck. You know what they pay these days? Minimum wage. Do you have a fucking clue what it's like to survive on minimum wage? I work 2 jobs at a time, 13 or 14 hours a day. That pays the rent, buys some food. Someone like you works, what, 8 hours a day plus summer vacation?
I teach summer school, she says.
It's a stupid thing to say. She knows it's a stupid thing to say before I give her the look. She doesn't know what it's like. She can't even imagine. I look up at the sky, at the dark clouds that threaten us. Not rain, but snow. It will be here soon. She pulls the blanket tighter around herself. She shudders from the cold. She knows that I would never let her leave. I have more to lose than she does.
You've done this kind of thing before,
she says. Done what?
Kidnapping. Holding a gun to someone's head.
It isn't a question. Maybe, maybe not.
You didn't snatch me with the hands of a virgin.
I've started a fire. I drop the fish on the grill pan and they begin to sear. I've never bothered someone who didn't need to be bothered. But even I know that isn't true. I flip the fish. They're cooking faster than I want. I move them to the edge of the grill so they won't burn. It could be worse, I assure her. It could be much worse. We eat outside. She sits on the floor, her back pressed to the wooden planks of the deck rail. I offer her a chair. She says no thanks. She spreads her legs out before herself and crosses them at the ankles. The wind blows through the trees. We both turn to watch the leaves lose their hold on the branches and fall to the ground. And that's when we hear it. Footsteps on the shriveled leaves that cover the earth. It's the cat, I think, at first. But then know that the footsteps are too heavy for the scrawny little cat. Too deliberate. The girl and I exchange a look, and I put a finger to my lips and whisper, shh. And then I rise to my feet and feel the seat of my pants for a gun that isn't there.
Gabe, before. I was waiting to talk to the Dennetts until I had some hard facts, but it doesn't work out that way. I'm chomping down a greasy Italian beef sandwich at my desk, when Eve Dennett comes into the station and asks the receptionist if she can speak to me. I'm still wiping the au jus from my face with a stack of napkins when she approaches my desk. This is the first time she's ever been down to the station, and boy does she look out of place here. Much different than the drunken losers we usually have walking around. I smell her perfume before she ever arrives at my desk. She walks demurely as every sick bastard eyes her from across the room, jealous when her high heels come to a stop before me. Every cop knows I'm working the Dennett case, and they have an ongoing bet as to if and when I screw the whole thing up. I even saw the sergeant putting money on it. He said he'd need the pot when he and I both found ourselves out of a job. Hello, Detective. Mrs. Dennett. I haven't heard from you in a few days, she says. I was just wondering if there's any news. She carries an umbrella, which drips water on the linoleum floor. Her hair is matted down and windblown from the fury outside. It's a horrible day, windy and cold, not a day to be outside. You could have called, I say. I was out running errands, she says. But I know she's lying. No one would be out today if they didn't have to be. It's just one of those days. A day to lie around in pajamas and watch TV. I lead her to an interrogation room and ask her to have a seat. It's a dingy room, poorly lit, with a big table in the middle and a couple of folding chairs. She lays the umbrella on the ground but clutches her purse. I offer to take her coat. She says no thanks. It's cold in here. One of those damp colds that chills you straight to the bone. I sit down across from her and lay the Dennett file on the table. I see her eye the manila folder. I look at her delicate blue eyes. They've already begun to swell with tears. As the days pass by, all I can think is, what if I never find Mia? It's apparent that Mrs. Dennett breaks a little more with each passing hour. Her eyes are heavy and bloated, as if she no longer sleeps. I can't imagine what would become of her if Mia never came home. I think about Mrs. Dennett at all hours of the day and night. I imagine her lost and alone inside that mansion of a home, dreaming up all the horrific things that might have happened to her child. I feel this consummate need to protect her, to answer those burning questions that keep her awake at night. Who and where and why? I was going to call you, I say quietly. I was just waiting for some good news. Something has happened, Mrs. Dennett says. It isn't a question. It's as if she knew all along that something had happened, and that's what brought her down to the station today. Something bad. She lays her purse on the table and digs inside for a tissue. There's news. But that's all right now. I haven't quite figured out what it all means. If Judge Dennett was here, he would rip me a new one for not having all the answers. We think we know who Mia was with before she disappeared, I say. Someone identified the photo that's been on the news, and when we went to his apartment, we found some of Mia's belongings, her purse and her coat. I open the file and lay some photos across the table, ones taken of the apartment by the rookie who accompanied me the other day. Mrs. Dennett picks up the photo of the purse, one of those messenger bag types that you sling across your body. The bag is laying on the floor, a pair of sunglasses and a green wallet falling out onto the parquet floor. Mrs. Dennett brings a tissue to her eyes. You recognize something? I ask. I picked it out, that bag. I bought that for her. Who is he? She asks, not pausing between thoughts. She glances at the other photos, one at a time, then sets them down in a row. She folds her hands on the table. Colin Thatcher, I say. We ran the fingerprints we pulled from the apartment building in Uptown and came up with the man's true identity. Every other name in the apartment, on the mail, the cell phone, etc. A pseudonym, a charade. We pulled mugshots from previous arrests and compared with the forensic sketch. Bingo. I watch how Mrs. Dennett's hands shake before me, and how she tries and fails to control the trembling. It's without thought that I feel my own hand reach out and find hers. Ice-cold hands that melt in mine. I do it before she can hide them in her lap, hoping to disguise the terror she feels inside. There's some footage from the security cameras. Colin and Mia entering the apartment around 11 o'clock at night, then again later leaving the building. I want to see it, she says to my surprise. Her response is definite, not the kind of indecision I'm used to from her. I don't think that's a good idea, I say. The last thing Eve needs to see right now is the way Colin Thatcher hurled her daughter out of the building, and the distress in the girl's eyes. It's bad, she concludes. It's inconclusive, I lie. I don't want you to get the wrong impression, but there's nothing mistakable about the vigilant way the man hurries from the elevator, making certain no one sees, or the fear in the girl's eyes. She's crying. He mouths something that I'm certain contains the F-word. Something happened inside that apartment. The earlier footage couldn't be any different. Two lovebirds heading up for a quickie. But she was alive. Yes. Who is he? She asks. This Colin Thatcher. I release Mrs. Dennett's hand and reach inside the manila folder. I pull out the man's rap sheet. He's been arrested for a number of misdemeanors. Petty theft, trespassing, possession of marijuana. He served time for selling and is wanted for questioning in an ongoing racketeering case. According to his last probation officer, he went MIA a few years back and is essentially a wanted man. I couldn't begin to explain the horror in the woman's blue eyes. As a detective, I'm used to words like trespassing and racketeering and probation officer. But Mrs. Dennett has only heard these words on reruns of Law and Order. She couldn't begin to understand what it all means. The words themselves are elusive and hard to grasp. She's terrified that a man like this has her daughter. What would he want with Mia? Mrs. Dennett asks. I've asked myself this very question 1,000 times. Random crime is relatively rare. Most victims know their assailant. I don't know, I say. I have no idea. But I promise you, I'm going to find out.
Colin, before. The girl sets her plate on the wooden deck beside her, and then she rises beside me and we both stare, over the wooden railing, into the dense forest as a woman emerges. A 50-something woman with short brunette hair in jeans and a flannel shirt, pudgy hiking boots, and she's waving to us like she knows us. And a new thought crosses my mind. It's a trap.
Oh, thank heaven,
the woman says as she welcomes herself onto our property. She's trespassing. This is our space. No one was supposed to be here. I feel suffocated, smothered. She's got a water jug in a hand. She looks like she's walked 100 miles. Can we help you? The words eject from my mouth before I can figure out what's happening, what I'm going to do. My first thought? Get the gun and shoot her. Drop her body in the lake and run. I don't have the gun anymore, don't know where the girl is keeping it. But I could tie her up while I ransack the cabin for its hiding place. Under the mattress, in the bedroom, or along some crevice in the log walls.
I've got a flat, about 1/2 mile down the road,
she says.
You're the first cabin that wasn't deserted. I've been walking,
she says, and then stops to catch her breath.
Mind if I sit?
She asks. And when the girl manages a nod, she drops to the bottom step and guzzles from the water jug like someone who's been stranded in the desert for days. I feel my hand reach out and clutch the girl's, feel myself crush the bones of her hand until she lets out a whine. We forget all about our dinner. But the woman reminds us.
I'm sorry to interrupt,
she says, motioning to the plates on the floor.
I was just wondering if you might be able to help me fix the tire, or call someone, maybe. My phone has no reception around here,
she says, holding it up for the girl and me to see. She says again that she's so sorry to interrupt. Little does she know what she's intruding on. It's not just our dinner she's disturbing. My eyes drift to the girl. Now's her chance, I think. She could tell the woman. Tell her how this crazy person kidnapped her, how he's holding her captive in this cabin. I hold my breath, waiting for any number of things to go wrong. For the girl to tell, for the lady to be part of a ploy to catch me. She's working undercover, maybe, or for Dalmar. Or maybe she's just some lady who watches the news and sooner or later she's going to realize that that girl is the one she's been seeing on TV. We don't have a phone, I say, remembering how I dropped the girl's cell in the garbage can in Janesville, how I cut the phone lines when we arrived at the cabin. Not that I can have her stepping foot inside our cabin, seeing the way we've been living for weeks, like 2 convicts on the run. But I can help you, I say begrudgingly.
I don't mean to be a bother,
the woman says, and the girl simultaneously says,
I'll just stay here and do the dishes,
as she squats to the ground to retrieve our plates. No chance in hell that's going to happen. You better come with, I say to her. We might need your help. But the old lady says,
Oh, please, I don't want to drag you both out tonight.
And she pulls her flannel shirt around herself and says that it's cold. But of course I can't leave her alone, though the woman promises to be an excellent assistant. She begs me not to drag my girlfriend out on a night like tonight. It's cold out, she says. Nightfall is coming soon. But I can't leave her. If I leave her here, she might just run. I picture her, tearing through the woods as fast as she can, 1 mile or so away by the time I manage to fix the flat and get back. It would be dark by then, and there'd be no chance in hell I'd be able to search the woods in the dark and find her. The woman apologizes for doing this, for being such an inconvenience. I picture my hands closing in around her neck, compressing the jugular vein to stop the flow of oxygen to the brain. Maybe that's what I should do.
I'm just going to do the dishes,
the girl objects quietly.
So we don't have to worry about it later.
And she gives me a playful look, as if implying intimate plans later tonight. I think you should come, I say gently, laying a hand on her arm as if I can't possibly stand the idea of being apart.
Romantic getaway?
The woman asks. I say, yeah, something like that. And then turn to the girl and whisper roughly, you're coming. I lean closer and add, or that lady doesn't leave here alive. She's deathly still for a split second. Then she sets the plates on the ground and we head for the truck and climb in, the woman and me in the front seat, the girl smashed in the back. I swipe remnants of rope and duct tape from the passenger seat, hoping the woman didn't see. I thrust them in the glove compartment and slam the door, and then turn to her and smile. Where to? In the truck, the woman tells us how she's from southern Illinois, how she and some girlfriends stayed at some lodge and went canoeing in the boundary waters. She pulls out a camera from her purse and shows us digital images of the four old ladies, in the canoe, with sun hats on, drinking wine around a fire. This makes me feel better. Not a trap, I think. Here's the proof, the pictures. She was canoeing with girlfriends in the boundary waters. But she tells us, like I give a shit, decided to stay an extra couple days. She's a recent divorcee, in no rush to return to an abandoned home. A recent divorcee, I think. No one at home waiting for her return. There would be time before she was reported missing, days, if not more. Enough time for me to run, to be far enough away when someone stumbled upon her body.
And then there I was, she says, making my way back to civilization when I got a flat. Must have hit a rock, she says, or a nail.
The girl responds impassively.
Must have,
she says. But I can hardly listen. We pull up behind a compact car, but before we get out, my eyes survey the thick woods that surround us. I peer through the tangle of trees for cops, binoculars, rifles. I check to make sure the tire is flat. It is. If this was an ambush, no one would go to such elaborate measures to trap me. By now, as I step from the truck and approach the abandoned car, I'd be face down on the ground, someone on top of me with a pair of cuffs. I see the woman watching me as I grab some tools out of the bed of the truck and remove the hubcap and loosen the nuts as I jack up the car and switch the tires. The ladies are talking about canoeing and the northern Minnesota woods, about red wine and a moose which the lady saw on her trip, a male with enormous antlers strolling through the trees. I make believe she's trying hard to connect the dots, trying to remember whether or not she saw us on TV. But I remind myself that she's been in the middle of nowhere with girlfriends. She was canoeing, sitting around a campfire, drinking wine. She wasn't watching TV. I thrust a flashlight in the girl's hands and tell her to hold it. It's getting dark out by now, and there isn't a street light around. My eyes threaten her when they meet, reminding her to avoid words like gun and kidnap and help. I'll kill them both. I know it. I wonder if she does. When the woman asks about our trip, I see the girl turn to stone.
How long are you staying? The woman asks.
When the girl can't answer, I say, just about another week.
Where are you all from?
She asks. Green Bay, I say.
Is that right?
She asks.
I saw the Illinois plates and thought,
just haven't gotten around to changing them, is all. I say, cursing myself for the mistake.
You're from Illinois?
She asks.
Originally?
Yep, I say. But I don't tell her where we're from.
I've got a cousin in Green Bay, just outside, actually, in Suamico.
I've never heard of the damn place, but still, she's talking. How her cousin is a principal at one of the middle schools, She's got this dull brown hair, short like an old lady's hair. She laughs when the conversation goes quiet, nervous laughter, then looks for something else to say. Anything else.
Are you all Packers fans?
She asks, and I lie and say that I am. I thrust on the spare as fast as I possibly can, then lower the car and tighten the lug nuts and stand, looking at the woman, wondering if I can just let her go, back to civilization where she might just figure out who we are and call the cops, or if I need to smash her head in with the wrench and leave her in the woods for good.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate it, she says,
and I think of my own mother, lying in the abandoned woods to be eaten by bears, and I nod and say it was okay. It's dark enough out that I can barely see her, and she can barely see me. I grip the wrench in my hand, wondering how hard I'd have to hit her to kill her. How many times? Wondering if she'd have it in her to fight, or if she'd just drop to the ground and die.
I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't found you.
And she steps forward to shake my hand and says,
I don't think I caught your names.
I clutch that wrench in my hand. I can feel it shake. It's far better than killing her with my bare hands, much less personal. I don't have to stare into her eyes while she struggles. One good hit and it will all be done. Owen, I say, clutching her cold, veiny hand in mine. And this is Chloe. And she says that she's Beth. I don't know how long we all stand there, on the dark street in silence, my heart beating fast as I eye a hammer in the toolbox. Maybe a hammer would be better. But then I feel the girl's hand on my arm, and she says to me,
We should go.
I turn to her, and know she sees what I'm thinking, sees the way I've got that wrench gripped in my hand, ready to strike.
Let's go,
she says again, her nails digging into my skin. I drop the wrench into a toolbox and set it in the bed of the truck. I watch as the woman climbs into her car and drives away, slowly, headlights swerving through the thick trees. I'm gasping for air, my hands a sweaty mess as I open the truck door and step inside and try to catch my breath.
Eve, after. We sit in the waiting room, James, Mia, and me. Mia sandwiched in the middle like the cream filling of an Oreo cookie. I sit in silence with my legs crossed and my hands folded on my lap. I stare at a painting on the wall opposite her, one of many Norman Rockwells in the room, of an old man holding a stethoscope to a little girl's doll. James sits with his legs crossed as well, ankle to knee, flipping through the pages of a parents' magazine. His breathing is loud and impatient. I ask him to please stop. We've been waiting more than 30 minutes to see the doctor, the wife of a judge friend of James's. I wonder if Mia considers it odd that every magazine cover in the entire room is cloaked with babies. People size her up. There are whispers, and we hear Mia's hushed name escape from the tongue of strangers. I pat her hand and tell her not to worry. Just ignore them, I say. But it's hard for either of us to do. James asks reception if they can hurry things along, and a short, red-headed woman disappears to see what is taking so long. We haven't told Mia the real reason why she's here today. We didn't discuss my suspicions. Instead, we told her that we were worried that she hasn't been feeling well lately, and James suggested a doctor, one whose Russian name is nearly impossible to pronounce. Mia told us she had her own doctor, one in the city who she's been seeing for half a dozen years, but James shook his head and said, No, Dr. Wakrikov is the best. It never occurs to her that the woman is an OBGYN. The nurse calls her name, though, of course, she says, Mia, and it takes an elbow from James to get her attention. She sets her magazine on the chair, and I look at her with indulgent eyes and ask if she wants me to keep her company. If you want, she says, and I wait for James to disapprove, but he is silent. The nurse stares strangely at Mia as she weighs her and gets a height. She eyes poor Mia like she's a celebrity of some sort, instead of the victim of a horrible crime.
"I saw you on TV," she says.
The words come out sheepishly, as if she isn't quite sure whether she said them aloud or managed to keep them in her head.
"I read about you in the paper."
Neither Mia nor I am quite sure what to say. Mia has seen the collection of newspaper articles I clipped during the time she was away. I tried to hide them in a place where she wouldn't see, but she did anyway when she was looking for a needle and thread in my dresser drawer to replace a button that had fallen from a blouse. I didn't want Mia to see the articles for fear of what they might do to her, but she did nonetheless, reading each and every one until I interrupted her, reading about her own disappearance, about how the police had a suspect, about how, as time went on, it was feared she might be dead. The nurse sends her to the bathroom to urinate in a cup. Moments later, I meet her in the examination room, where the nurse takes Mia's blood pressure and pulse, then asks that she undress and put on a gown. She says that Dr. Wakrukov will be with us in a few minutes, and as Mia begins to undress, I turn my back. Dr. Wakrukov is a somber, subdued woman who must be approaching 60. She comes into the room quite abruptly and says to Mia, "When was your last menstrual period?" Mia must find the question terribly odd.
I have no idea, she says.
And the doctor nods, remembering only then, perhaps, of Mia's amnesia. She says that she's going to perform a transvaginal ultrasound and covers a probe with a condom and some sort of gel. She asks that Mia sticks her feet into the stirrups, and without an explanation, she plunges the device into her. Mia winces and begs to know what she's doing, wondering what this has to do with her overwhelming fatigue, with the listlessness that makes it nearly impossible to rise from sleep in the morning. I remain silent. I long to be in the waiting room beside James, but I remind myself that Mia needs me here and let my eyes wander around the room, anything to avoid the doctor's very intrusive examination and Mia's obvious confusion and discomfort. I decide then that I should have told Mia about my suspicions. I should have explained that the fatigue and the morning sickness are not symptoms of acute stress disorder, but perhaps she wouldn't have believed me. The exam room, I find, is as sterile as the doctor. It's cold enough in here to kill germs. Perhaps that is the intention. Mia's bare flesh is coated with goosebumps. I'm certain it doesn't help that she's completely nude, with the exception of a paper robe. Bright fluorescent lights line the ceiling, revealing every graying hair on the middle-aged doctor's head. She doesn't smile. She looks Russian. High cheekbones, a slender nose. But when she speaks, she doesn't sound Russian. "Confirming the pregnancy," the doctor states, as if this is common knowledge, something Mia should know. My legs become anaesthetized and I sink my way into an extra chair, one placed here for elated men who are soon to be fathers. Not me, I think. This chair is not meant for me. Babies develop a heartbeat 22 days after conception. You can't always see it this early, but there is one here. It's tiny, hardly noticeable. See? She asks as she turns the monitor to Mia. That little flicker of movement, she asks as she points a finger at a dark blob that is practically still.
What?
Mia asks. Here, let me see if I can get a better look. The doctor says, and as she presses on the probe, which delves farther into Mia's vagina, Mia squirms in apparent pain and discomfort, and the doctor asks her to hold still. But Mia's question was something other than what the doctor interpreted it to be. It wasn't that Mia couldn't see where her finger was pointing. I watch as Mia lets a hand fall to her abdomen.
It just can't be.
Here, the doctor says as she removes the probe and hands Mia a tiny piece of paper. A whimsy of blacks and whites and greys like a lovely piece of abstract art. It's a photograph, much like the one of Mia herself long before she became a child. I clutch my purse in my shaking hands, ravaging its insides for a tissue.
"What's this?" Mia asks. "It's the baby, a printout from the ultrasound."
She tells Mia to go ahead and sit up and pulls a latex glove from her hand, which she tosses into the garbage can. Her words are lifeless, as if she has given this lecture 1,000 times. Mia is to come back every 4 weeks until she reaches 32 weeks, then bi-weekly and a few weeks later every week. There are tests they need to run, blood tests and an amniocentesis if she wants, a glucose tolerance test, a test for group B strep. At 20 weeks, Dr. Wakrakoff tells Mia she can find out the sex of the baby if she's interested. Is that something you might want to do?
I don't know, is all Mia manages to say.
The doctor asks if Mia has any questions. She has only one, but she can barely find her voice. She tries, and then, clearing her throat, tries again. It's spineless and faint, little more than a whisper.
"I'm pregnant?" she asks.
This is every little girl's dream. They begin thinking about it when they're too young to know where babies come from. They carry around their baby dolls and mother them and dream of baby names. When Mia was a girl, it was always overtly flowery names that flowed off the tip of a tongue. Isabella and Samantha and Savannah. Then there was that phase where she thought everything should end in I. Jenny, Danny and Laurie. It never crossed her mind that she might have a boy.
You are. About 5 weeks.
This is not the way it's supposed to be. She rubs a hand against her uterus and hopes to feel something, a heartbeat or a small kick. Of course, it would be too early, and yet she hopes to feel the flutter of movement inside her, but she feels nothing. I can see it in her eyes when she turns and finds me weeping. She feels empty. She feels hollow inside. She confides to me,
"It can't be. I can't be pregnant."
Dr. Wakrakoff pulls up a swivel stool and sits down. She drapes the gown over Mia's legs and then says, her voice softer now,
"You don't remember this happening?"
Mia shakes her head no.
"Jason," she says,
but she's shaking her head.
"It's been months since I've been with Jason."
She counts them on her fingers, September, October, November, December, January. 5 months, she concludes. The math simply does not add up. But of course, I know Jason is not the father of that child.
"You have time to decide what you'd like to do. There are options."
The doctor is producing pamphlets for Mia, adoption and abortion, and the words are coming at her so fast that she can't possibly keep up. The doctor sends for James, allowing Mia a few minutes to get dressed before the nurse brings him in. While we're waiting, I ask Mia if I can see the ultrasound. She hands it to me, her lifeless words repeating,
"It just can't be."
It's then, taking that photograph in my hands and laying my eyes on my grandchild, my own flesh and blood, that I begin to cry. As James enters the room, the crying turns into a moan. I try to suppress the tears, but simply can't. I yank paper towels from a dispenser on the wall and blot my eyes. It's just as Dr. Wakrakoff returns that I can no longer hold it inside, and I wail,
"He raped you! That bastard raped you!"
But still, Mia feels nothing.
Colin, before. Winter has arrived. It was snowing when we woke, and the temperature in the cabin has dropped by what felt like 20 degrees. There's no warm water. She layers on all the clothes she can find. She puts on 2 pairs of long johns and that gangly maroon sweatshirt. She slips on a pair of socks, complaining that she hates to wear socks, but without them her feet would freeze. She says that she's always hated socks, even when she was a baby. She would rip them from her feet and throw them to the floor beside her crib. I haven't admitted to being cold before, but it's fucking freezing. I started a fire the moment I woke up. I've already had 3 cups of coffee. I'm sitting with an old, torn U.S. map spread across the table. I found it in the glove compartment, along with an all-but-dried-up pen, and I'm circling the best routes to get us the hell out of here. I've got my mind set on the desert, somewhere between Las Vegas and Baker, California. Somewhere warm. I'm wondering how to make a detour to Gary, Indiana first, without highway patrol spotting the truck. I figure we'd have to ditch the truck and swipe a new one, somehow, and hope it doesn't ever get reported. That or hop a freight train. Assuming people are looking for us, there could be roadblocks in our honor, especially around Gary, just in case I have the nerve to go home. Maybe the police are using her as bait. Maybe they've got a surveillance team lined up around the old Gary home, waiting for me to call or make a stupid move. Damn. Going somewhere? The girl asks, looking at the map as I fold it up and push it away. I don't answer her question. Want some coffee? I ask instead, knowing we couldn't stay in the desert for long. Squatting in the desert nixes any chance of a quasi-normal life. It would be all about survival. We can't go to the desert, I decide, then and there. The only chance we stand is somewhere abroad. We don't have enough cash for a flight anymore, so the way I see it, there's 2 choices, up or down, north or south, Canada or Mexico. But of course, to get out of the country, we need passports. And that's when it hits me, what I have to do. She shakes her head no. You don't drink coffee?
No.
You don't like it?
I don't drink caffeine.
She tells me that she did drink caffeine for a long time, but it made her agitated and jittery. She couldn't sit still. Eventually, the caffeine high would fade, only to be replaced by extreme fatigue. So she'd have another cup of coffee. A vicious circle.
And when I tried to avoid caffeine, she said, I'd succumb to debilitating headaches, only to be soothed with Mountain Dew.
But I pour her a cup anyway. She takes the warm mug into her hands and presses her face to the rim. The steam rises up to meet her. She knows she shouldn't, but she does it anyway. She raises the mug to her lips and allows it to sit there. Then she takes a sip, burning every bit of her esophagus on the way down. She chokes. Be careful, I say too late. It's hot. There isn't a damn thing to do but sit and stare at each other. So when she said she wanted to draw me, I said, okay, there isn't anything else to do. To be straight, I don't want to do it. At first it's not a big deal, but then she wants me to hold still and look straight and smile. Forget it, I say, I'm done. I stand up. I'll be damned if I'm going to sit here and smile at her for the next half hour.
Okay, she concedes. Don't smile. Don't even look at me. Just sit still.
She places me beside the fire. She presses her frigid hands to my chest. She lowers me into place on the floor. My back all but touches the stove. The flame nearly burns a hole in my shirt and I begin to sweat. I think of the last time she touched me. The desperation of her hands as she tried to undress me. And the last time I touched her, smacking her across the face. The room is gloomy. The dark pine logs of the walls and ceiling blocking any light. I count the log walls, stacked 15 high. There is no sun to pass through the small windows. I look at her. She isn't all that bad to look at. She was beautiful that first night in my apartment. She watched me with these unsuspecting blue eyes, never thinking for a minute that I had it in me to do this. She sits on the floor and leans against the couch. She pulls her legs into her and rests the notebook on her knees. She takes a pencil from the pack, extracts the lead.
She tilts her head and her hair falls clumsily to one side. Her eyes trace the shape of my face, the curve of my nose. I don't know why, but I feel the urge to knock the guy who was with her before me. I paid him off, I confess. Your boyfriend? I gave him $100 to make himself busy for the night. He didn't ask why, and I didn't say. The coward just grabbed the money from my hand and disappeared into thin air. I don't tell her I confronted him in the John with my gun. $100 can buy a lot these days.
He had to work,
she says. That's what he told you.
Jason works late all the time.
Or so he says.
It's the truth.
Sometimes, maybe.
He's very successful.
At lying.
So you paid him off. So what?
She snaps. Why'd you come home with me? I ask.
What?
Why did you come home with me that night? She forces a swallow and doesn't respond. She pretends to be lost in her work, the fury of her lines as she sketches maniacally across the page. I didn't realize it was a hard question, I say. Her eyes well up. A vein in her forehead protrudes through the skin. Her skin becomes clammy and her hands shake. She's mad.
I was drunk.
Drunk?
Yes, I was drunk.
Because that's the only reason someone like you would come home with someone like me, right?
Because that's the only reason I would go home with you.
She's watching me, and I wonder what it is she sees, what she believes she sees. She thinks I'm numb to her indifference. But she's wrong. I take off my sweatshirt and drop it to the floor beside my clamorous boots. I've got on an undershirt and jeans that she's probably never seen me without. She scribbles my face on the page, delirious lines and shadows to describe the demon she sees before the fire. She had a few drinks that night, but she was lucid enough to know what she was doing, to welcome my hands on her. Of course, that was long before she knew who I really was. I don't know how long we're silent. I hear her breathe, the sound of lead striking the paper's surface. I can almost hear her thoughts in my mind, the hostility and anger. It's like cigarettes, or smoking pot, I finally say to her. The words startle her and she tries to catch her breath.
What is?
She doesn't stop drawing. She pretends, almost, like she's not listening. But she is. My life? What I do? You know they're bad for you the first time you try. Cigarettes, pot. But you convince yourself it's okay. You can handle it. One time, that's it. Just to see what it's like. And then all of a sudden you're sucked in. You can't get out if you want to. It wasn't because I needed the money so bad, which I did. It was because if I tried to get out, I'd be killed. Someone would rat me out and I'd end up in jail. There was never the option of saying no. She stops drawing. I wonder what she's going to say. Some smart-ass comment, I'm sure. But she doesn't. She doesn't say anything. But the vein in her forehead fades away. Her hands stand still. Her eyes soften. And she looks at me. And nods.
Eve, after. I watch from the hall as James thrusts himself into Mia's bedroom with great gusto, the sound of his footsteps outside the door, loud and clamorous, approaching quickly, startles her from sleep. She jumps upright in the bed, her eyes wide with fear, her heart lightly thrashing about inside her chest, as happens when one is scared. It takes a second for her to become aware of her surroundings, remnants of her high school wardrobe that still hang in the closet, the jute rug, a poster of Leonardo DiCaprio she hung when she was 14, and then it settles. She remembers where she is. She's home. She's safe. She drops her head into her hands and begins to cry. "You need to get dressed," James says. We're going to see the shrink. I enter the bedroom once he leaves and help Mia pick a matching outfit from the closet. I try to appease her fears, to remind her that here, in our home, she is perfectly safe. No one can hurt you, I promise. But even I am not sure. Mia eats in the car, just a piece of dry toast I brought along for the trip. She doesn't want a thing to do with it, but from the passenger seat, I turn around every few minutes and say to her, "Take another bite, Mia," as if she is 4 years old again. "Just one more bite." I thank Dr. Rhodes for squeezing us in so early in the morning. James pulls the doctor aside for a private word, as I help Mia out of her coat. And then I watch as Mia and Dr. Rhodes disappear behind closed doors. Dr. Rhodes will be speaking to Mia this morning about the baby. Mia is in denial about the fetus growing in her womb, and I suppose I am as well. She is hardly able to say the word, baby. It gets lost in her throat, and every time James or I breach the subject,